From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents the final excerpt from its recent conference on the practice of medicine today, a discussion covering aspects of medical ethics and medical education. The speakers are Dr. Chase Peterson, Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Utah, Dr. Alan Dyer, a professor of psychiatry at Duke Medical Center and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, Dr. Thomas Ballantyne, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and William Bennett, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
We train doctors to be good technicians, and the whole tradition of medicine has been to put your patient first. And that's a kind of a narcissism in itself by transference. Mm-hmm. The patient has hired a doctor to be narcissistic for him, mm-hmm. in other words, the way we think you can hire lawyers to represent your point of view even if it's unethical.
Good.
And so doctors are not trained traditionally or actually to deal with the larger questions of ethics and society. And when it comes to allocating finite resources, they're not prepared, therefore, to allocate those. And so you assume someone else is doing it, but there's no one else at the wheel right now. Mm-hmm. Society thought doctors would handle that somehow or another. Doctors aren't trained to do so. Who else can do it? The governor of the state of Utah has insufficient Medicaid money right now, so he simply said, discharge patients on Medicaid after 28 days. I understand why he says that, but you can't do that. That's an illogical and immoral way to put a cap on medical spending.
I agree that this is a good statement of the problem, but I'm concerned about one aspect of it, which is that the doctor become a double agent, responsible to the patient and responsible to the society or to the third party who's paying for it. And I think it's very important that the doctor maintain his or her allegiance to the patient as an advocate for the patient and for the patient's interest. And if the question of allocation of resources comes in, as it inevitably must, then it'd be important to keep the doctor and the patient on the same side of the net and work as a team together in dealing with some other agent who will represent the question of allocation of resources.
Well, you not only have the problem of the allocation of resources, but I would think the problem of the allocation of responsibilities. Again, going back to this new code of medical ethics of the American Medical Association, which is a guide, I think, for all ethical considerations by all organizations within medicine. It says that the medical profession has long subscribed to a body of ethical statements developed primarily for the benefit of the patient. And then there is a but. But as a member of this profession, a physician must recognize responsibility not only to patients, but also to society, to other health professionals, and to self. Now, how do you allocate those responsibilities? Our primary responsibility is to the patient. Otherwise, as Alan has so beautifully stated it, he is suspect as being a double agent. But then I think one of the things that perhaps we physicians have lost, which we had in revolutionary times in the 19th century, was a sense of responsibility to society in the context of being an educated person who could help mold opinion within that society in which he lived. In other words, in a small town in Oklahoma, who are your prominent citizens? They were the minister, the judge, and the doctor. These were the people that the rest of society looked to help them make collective decisions. And in some ways, I think we have drawn away from that responsibility with the idea, as I have heard it said, when I tried to enlist my physicians to work hard on some non-medical problem in society, well, some of us have to take care of patients, and so you get back into that cocoon and say these problems can be addressed by other individuals. Chase, you've lived a very broad life. How do you think physicians should handle their multiple responsibilities? Or do you think perhaps they They don't have that society should make the decisions.
I think I side with Alan that the bonding, the support, the education that goes on in that kind of relationship, we've got to say to ourselves, isn't there some way that we can get society to stand on its tiptoes morally, reach for its excellence, and then incorporate that into cultural standards or laws or something, which will then guide the rest of society when it lapses back into kind of moral stupor that all of us at different times are in.
I know Alan may not agree with me on this, but I think, first I would say I agree with both Chase and Alan that, right, the doctor should be primarily, principally addressing the needs of the patient. I think that's the way it works, and if doctors start taking the long social view on everything, I think they're very soon going to be very bad doctors. Nobody's going to get cured, nobody's going to get acquitted, nobody's going to get taught. Everybody's just going to be going around doing social philosophy. But and then maybe I'll be out of business, so you see I have a special interest in sort of keeping you guys in your area. But look, I don't think it's that problematic. One's a doctor, that means one primarily worries about the care of the patient. But one is also a citizen. So one takes one's, it's because one's a citizen, not because one's a doctor, that one has a social responsibility. It's because you're a citizen. And then as a citizen, you have to ration yourself again, and you get involved in things that you know about and can contribute to, apart from all the things that all citizens must, you know, by necessity be involved in or ought to be, like voting and caring about the well-being of their community and so on. Then, you know, in some of these hard cases, whole panoply of issues, one gets involved in an active way if one has something to say. And of course, working that out in detail is another question. But I think it's important that one not see the burdens of professional life as so onerous, so overwhelming, that one falls into despair, because that can happen too. No one, I think, has an obligation to burn out. No one had a clearer idea about one's responsibilities to oneself and to one's society than Aristotle. And he insists that one has important responsibilities to oneself, that one keep one's balance, one's equilibrium, one's state of well-being, one relax, one take time off, for example, in order to sustain the long haul. The kind of moral heroics that some people like to, you know, to put the mantle on and sort of jump into all things. Well, we've all seen examples of that, I guess, among friends of ours, that can often lead to burnout.
If anything plagues medicine, it's burnout. The traditions of medical education, Osler said that a doctor shouldn't get married till he's 39, because that's when he's fully trained, and you shouldn't just distract yourself with other things until you're fully trained.
Exactly.
And there are great medical educators still in this country who are continuing the tradition of absolute devotion to medical training during house staff and residency days, to the degree that you might have 6 hours off a week to be with your families and so forth. Mm-hmm. After the education is completed, if this mold has taken hold, a doctor tends to feel guilty if he hasn't given almost that same amount of time to his patients. Now, we're talking about planning an education for people, not for heroes. Mm-hmm. For average people, for honorable, common mm-hmm. people, yeah. Not superheroes.
Yeah.
And if the only mold that allows a doctor to feel really proud is a super mold hero, mm-hmm. he's constantly going to fall short of that. And I used to see it in rural docs who didn't have the benefit of patience and coordinated time off schedules with other doctors and so forth, didn't have coordinated clinics, I meant to say, and time off schedules. So they would throw themselves into a small town. They were on call 7 days a week, all the time. Their numbers couldn't be unlisted and that sort of nicety of a big city practice. And after 5 or 6 years, they left. Because the only way they could was to move to another new town, because then they had a couple of months or years until the practice built up again. And they were constantly going up to peaks and falling off and crashing, and then had a little respite until they climbed another peak. Now, there's something wrong in the tradition of Sir William Osler, or our medical education, or in the doctor-patient access relationship that allows our doctors to get caught in syndromes like that.
it's a situation of the patient being in control, and the doctor feels very guilty, as you point out. The doctor who feels guilty is perhaps not rendering the best care possible in saying to the patient, we have to set limits, and I can show you how to do that because I can do that, and I'm willing to spend some time with you. It's this much time, and to tell the patient how much time that will be. And if you need more time, we'll arrange that on another occasion, but today, this is how much time I can spend with you.
And Alan, one of the consequences of that untempered relationship is rage, quiet rage on the part of the doctor against the patient.
That's right.
They can't express it because it isn't the patient's fault. But you are a prisoner of your patients. And if you haven't learned these kind of tools that you're touching on now, you just sit there being smothered and weighed down by the needs of your patient and, to some extent, the adoration of your patient. Very malignant emotion, that adoration.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the final excerpt from the Center's recent conference on the practice of medicine today. The speakers are William Bennett, Chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Dr. Chase Peterson, Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Utah, Dr. Thomas Ballantyne, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Alan Dyer, a professor of psychiatry at Duke Medical Center and a scholar at the National Humanities Center.
It's been said by Dr. Carlton Chapman and others that lots of people say that medical school admissions committees want people to have a good liberal education before they get there. It's also been said by Chapman and others that medical school admissions committees aren't serious about that, that in the end, you better major in science, biology, or chemistry, and you better not major in philosophy or literature. Your odds are a lot better if you don't. Now, I'm someone who believes in liberal education, but I'm also someone who believes in the right education of doctors. And as far as I'm concerned, if one really should major in biology or chemistry and immerse in those disciplines in college in order to get into medical school, in order to be a good doctor, then that's fine with me. But I'd like to know what's true here.
Let me try to answer that question. It seems to me that if you want to believe in liberal arts, and I do with you, Bill, you've got to say liberal arts and. You've got to have the science and liberal arts. And I don't think it's any burden to put on a student or on a medical selection committee to say, let's be sure that person can do science. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't require 50 courses in science. Mm-hmm. That requires 4 or 6 or 7 courses in college in science. But they ought to do well, and there's no reason why a liberal arts science GPA should be lower than a science major's GPA. Uh-huh. So if they've taken care of the science, and then can go on and develop larger parts of their personality in a liberal arts course, then I think medical schools should and probably do recognize the greater value of that kind of education.
That was my second question. You've been a dean of admissions, not of a medical school. Maybe you have done that too. I don't know. Some okay, but is it true? Do medical school admissions committees take that seriously?
One of the standards for admission, of course, is that people want to replicate themselves. So they're looking for people like themselves. And people that are on medical admissions committees are by and large professors in medical schools, and they have chosen not to be primarily practitioners, but more scientists and teachers and researchers. So there is a danger that they would emphasize the science and the narrow science over the broader aspects. But I think most admissions committees, at least ours, attempt to compensate for that. Let me answer it in a little broader context, though. In the reference you made to Dr. Chapman, he was critical of medical schools because they didn't teach enough concepts, and they concerned themselves with too much minutia. I guess I agree with him, but I would like him to be much more precise in the way he describes the relationship of concepts to minutia. If our medical schools were teaching people airy concepts, just general notions, unrelated to the facts that had to be developed laboriously over centuries to support those concepts, then I think that's a very dangerous kind of medical education, because there are 100 new concepts coming along. herbal medicine, sincerity of the doctor, holistic medicine, undefined. All these are very dangerous concepts if you don't know what their factual bases are. They're very exciting concepts in other ways if you know what you're talking about. I hope what he means by that is that medical schools have to select from among the scientific offerings they can offer their students, because there's too much to teach anybody in 4 years. But I hope they would take a case study and say, let us go deep into the science and the facts that underline the concepts in areas 1, 2, and 3, some basic medical area, basic surgical area, a basic psychiatric area maybe, and learn what those facts are, so that you'll have the capacity to be critical of specious concepts that come along later, and be able to go back and say, give me the basis, give me the data. I grew up in my house after days by a fellow that repeatedly said, Peterson, ideas are a dime or a dozen. Now, what are your facts? Well, I can't know all the facts. The medical student can't know all the facts, but they have to know the technique for getting at the facts when there's a concept that needs to be tested.
I would contend, when you talked about the preparation of a student who majored in college in philosophy and came to medical school, where you prepared him in college with a sound conceptual knowledge of science, that you're really describing a liberal education. And I think that this is an important point that people have lost track of. I think partly due to C.P. Snow's Two Cultures philosophy and the little monograph that he wrote about that you have to separate science from the humanities. And indeed, I think that's wrong, that if you're going to have a well-educated individual, whether he goes into law or theology, he has to know something about acid base. He has to have a grounding in physics if he's going to be a well-rounded individual. At the same time, on the other hand, I think in Alan Dyer's specialty of psychiatry, that if a psychiatrist isn't familiar with some of the plays of Shakespeare, he has lost an understanding of psychiatric illness that is very fundamental. And so I don't see that there is a distinction between the two.
Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased?
Yeah. Right. Or I know not why I am so sad. But I think our problem in medical education today is that the medical educators of today, by and large, are the individuals who got their education in the 60s and 70s, early 70s, and that they are passing along a tradition of hard science or of nihilism, and that they are not the well-rounded. And of course, you are of that generation, and I accept you naturally from because of your remarks, not because I'm being polite, but I've heard you speak. But by and large, if you look at your peers in the medical school, you'll see some people that really don't understand what education is all about, this contradistinction to the passing along of facts, which is not education in any way, sense, or form.
Tom, let me ask the question differently. What is teaching? Bill, I ask you this, because why do we have people in colleges and universities rather than just books? It's very cost ineffective. The answer must be that there's something about people in the transmission of facts that allows facts to be connected to concepts, and then concepts, in the case of medicine, concepts to be connected to patient application, patient care, and all of that in a necessarily personal perspective. And when you say all that, to me, I've said ethics.
I sometimes worry that people tend to romanticize liberal education, that is non-scientific part of liberal education, as if somehow the most broadly educated person will be the most effective professional. I don't know, it seems to me that the person should read Shakespeare primarily, maybe you guys think I'm wrong, for his own well-being, but not particularly for the patients. I don't really give a damn if my doctor or auto mechanic or lawyer has read Shakespeare. I've read Shakespeare. I want him to, you know, fix my thumb, my drive shaft, my will. Now, I do believe that the humanities are a resource that is unparalleled for enlightenment perspective on certain kinds of issues. But I would in no way want to jeopardize or sacrifice the competence of professionals in the field for some breadth which may make them more interesting people at a social gathering, but maybe would diminish their ability to fix my thumb, if you see my point. My thumb.
Chase Peterson has spoken of medical education as a moral apprenticeship and stresses, I think perhaps as an aspect of that, the competence of the physician, that it's important to know a lot of things and to be able to do a lot of things, but that values are an important part of that, and that one teaches ethics by being ethical and by being an example for young students. This is how it's done. So the facts are important, and how they're applied is important, and I think it's important to realize that in medical education, the place of facts is more than just a catalog of details. It is that, but it's more than that. It's also the application of them to people and to personal problems. Medicine is part of culture. It's part of the value systems of the world that we live in. And that's ambiguous. I guess the very least that could be said is that the physician has to be prepared to deal with ambiguity. There's a lot to it that one has to be responsible to one's own self, responsible to patients, responsible to society at large, and the responsibility is a key ingredient. We raise the question of what is medicine? Is it just a technique? Is it just a fixing of the machine that is the person, or is it a concern more broadly for the person as a human being whose machine may break down and may need some attention? And I think it's all of these things, and that's what makes medicine exciting and challenging.
Chase?
I've heard us say that medical ethics is not a problem in the broad middle range of issues facing doctors and patients. That doctors are by and large well-trained and willing to take on ethical responsibilities. And that we shouldn't paralyze that skill by preoccupation with some of the extreme cases for which we do not have legal or medical answers right now, but be fairly satisfied that we've got answers in the broad heartland of the issue. Having said that, and having said that the doctor should still be the advocate for the patient, there is an ethical framework in which the doctor and the patient together have to work that is not yet fully established in this country. And that's the framework that allocates resources. Because we have not been playing tennis with the net up in medicine since we got into the technical revolution that gave us the skills to do so many things for which money was required, and up to now we've had that money. From now on we won't have the money for all the things we can do for people, and unless you're asking the doctor to do the unfair and impossible, and that is personally allocate resources, in other words no longer be on the patient's team, then you've got to have some other system set up. And I think we probably can set up that system, but it will take a real act of will and courage on the part of our country, the citizens at large, to devise a system that will allow the doctor still to be the patient's advocate. If we don't devise that system, then we will have to turn off research, stop people from making advances for which we don't have an ethical financial allocation system. And if we do that, we have turned off our life, our culture, our future, and ironically, we will also have turned off our access to cost-saving inventions, even though some of them may not look like cost-saving inventions when they first start to be born.
Seems to me that we've ranged far and wide in this discussion, and the problems that we have considered are those of medical progress, for example. But have we paid a price for it? I think this is the question we have asked. Have we lost some of the fundamental characteristics of the healing art that really the patient and the population who are not patients expect of the physician? That is, that he should be part priest as well as part physician. That there is a moral imperative that goes with medicine that cannot be ignored, that cannot be downgraded. I've heard a casual approach to problems of ethics, saying, in a way, you people are a little bit too preoccupied with this. And I think this is true. If you want to talk about the a course in, quote, ethics, unquote. And so you get ethics. So then you pass an examination and you're now ethical. Well, of course, that's nonsense. And yet, on the other side of this issue, we have problems in moral judgment today that physicians have never faced before. In the beginning, as I said, when we started this program of life, and in the ending of life. And unless we can, in our own selves, come to grips with this problem, these problems as physicians, how can we ask society to help us make a judgment as to what is rightful behavior in society and what is best for the patient? These are the problems that I see. And I also would like to say one more thing, that what has been brought out loud and clear today is that the ethical problems that we face day in and day out as physicians are relatively small problems, but they're extremely important problems that will shape our approach to the bigger problems. And that is the fact that an ethical decision must be made within the recesses of a man's heart and his mind, and there is no way that he can go to a book of regulations to make these decisions. Do you put in that extra stitch for an extra $5, for example? Who knows whether the patient needs that extra stitch except the man that's putting it in? And he must ask himself, am I doing this for money, or am I doing it to have a better wound? I think that I've learned a tremendous amount. I know I have. And I'm very grateful for this opportunity to exchange these views.
I'm worried about ethics still, as a fashion or as a fad. I still think it is, and I still think it's pursued in lots of places because it's a fashionable thing to do. I'm reminded of a cab driver I had in California once. I told him I was did work in ethics, and he said to me, oh yeah, I was into ethics for a while, now I'm into body surfing. it's got to be obviously deeper than that. We've got to take it seriously and continuously. I think that that one of the blessings of the humanities, if you'll allow me, is, as a friend of mine who's in the humanities and a bit of a wag says, that what to the social scientist is a new discovery is to the student of the humanities who knows his facts, simply a repetition of something that's gone on before. Every John Donne says in his poem, 10th Anniversary, that now the world is all in doubt, or philosophy casts all in doubt, it's a new world, what are we going to do, we're under crisis, and so on. And this seems to be simply one of the things that human beings have to go through generation to generation. I, in fact, don't think it's essentially a brave new world or a radically new world that we're facing hard choices, and those choices human beings have faced them before. What it will take is intelligence and goodwill, candor, and again, some degree of spiritedness. And the thing I hope, the attitude I hope we can all keep, is that in talking about the ethics and ethical responsibility of all of us, citizens, doctors, whatever we are, that we don't think of those responsibilities with a grimace as something to put us into despair, but as invitations to apply the good sense and goodwill that we've applied in other situations and carry forward. So onward and upward as another private citizen, again as a private citizen, I want to say I'm grateful to, I must say I'm grateful to the medical profession, both for the care it gave me as a child and continues to give me. I just hope that in soul searching, you guys don't decide to quit the profession and go collect shells on the beach.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond inviting you to join me for Soundings. The topic will be the practice of medicine today, part 6 of a discussion of medical ethics. This week, the conversation focuses on allocation of medical resources and on American medical education. My guests include 3 distinguished physicians and the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. That's The Practice of Medicine Today, part 6, this week on Soundings.